Hello, and welcome to Monster Man, a show about monsters because monsters are great. I'm James Holloway, and I'm reading my way through the 1977 Advanced Dungeons & Dragons 1st Edition Monster Manual. And as I do, I'm talking about the monsters that I find therein. Their history, their mythology, their ecology, their imagery, and how to use them in games. Or, I am on a normal episode of this podcast. But this is a special episode. A special episode brought to you by the generosity of my Patreon backers. These are people who've gone to patreon.com/monsterman and pledged as little as $1 a month to support the show. And if, like today's sponsor, you back at the $5 a month level, you'll get the opportunity to choose a monster from the Monster Manual, or elsewhere these days, to get a special in-depth episode. And that special in-depth episode is what you're listening to right now, brought to every listener of Monster Man, free, gratis, and for nothing, by the generosity of Patreon supporter Reb. So, Reb, thank you very much. Reb has chosen, as the topic of today's episode, the Mimic, a monster that Reb passionately hates, by which I mean kind of likes, I guess. Because we're close to the end of the alphabet in the main series of Monster Man, we've already talked about the basics of the Mimic, way back in episode 40, in which we also talked about the Merman and the Mind Flayer. So this is going to be like an in-depth episode in which we talk a little bit more about Mimics, what they mean, what their history is, and what you can do with them. So let's get started. Now, first things first, normally in an episode like this one, I would go into some more detail about the mythological background of the creature, but like the subject of our last episode, the Bodok, the Mimic doesn't really have a mythological background other than the kind of artistic tradition of, you know, objects that are really creatures. But even then, I don't think that there's anything quite like the Mimic. You get sort of, you know, the Sorcerer's Apprentice brooms and things like that, or mops, I guess. But I don't know that there is much of a literary tradition of creatures that look like objects. I want to say, there's a Fafhrd and the Grey Mouser story where there's a creature that looks like a building? Don't quote me on that, but I think that's the case. Anyway, the Mimic is a creature original to Dungeons & Dragons, as far as I can tell, and one that obviously exists within what we might call the dungeon ecology. That is to say, one where, you know, adventurers know that there are treasure chests all over the place and you go up and open them. Now, like its fellow dungeon inhabitants, the Lurker Above, the Trapper, the Piercer, the Gelatinous Cube, and so on, the Mimic is essentially a biological trap. That is, it's an answer to the question, how can I get some fun trap gameplay into this dungeon when this dungeon doesn't have any inhabitants or past inhabitants who would set up a trap, right? It's essentially a monster that functions like a trap. You don't really fight mimics, or you do, and they're pretty tough, actually. But the fun part is detecting them and having, you know, not having to fight them. Or at least, it ought be. As far as I am aware, the first appearance of the Mimic is, in fact, right here in the 1977 First Edition Monster Manual. And like a lot of creatures in the Monster Manual, it was later expanded on in the pages of Dragon Magazine. And a lot of these monsters got their descriptions expanded in these articles called The Ecology of the Whatever that appeared in Dragon. And I've mentioned one before, The Ecology of the Sioux Monster, which is one of the first Dungeons & Dragons articles I ever read, actually. I would occasionally read Dragon Magazine, even though I didn't play D&D in those days. And one of those dragons I read as a youngin had an article on The Ecology of the Sioux Monster, which did not make me care any more about the Sioux Monster. I gotta be 100% honest with you. But the article on The Ecology of the Mimic is regarded as something of a classic. It was written by Ed Greenwood, and it appears in an issue of Dragon Magazine from July 1983. I want to say this issue like 35? I'd have to look it up, but Greenwood's article is notable largely because of the sort of scientific spin that it tries to put on the Mimic. And this is something that you get in a lot of this 1980s Dungeons & Dragons. Attempts to create kind of naturalistic, almost science fictional explanations for creatures that frankly don't really bear that kind of weight. But this makes for interesting reading. Here's an extract. The Mimic gains its name from its ability to alter not only its body shape, but the color and texture of the outer surface as well. The color and texture changes are accomplished by shifting pigmented liquid between interior and exterior body cells, so that the creature resembles wood or stone in color and texture, depending on whether this pigmented liquid is brought to the outer surface of the creature's body or stored internally. A mimic is naturally gray in hue, with a smooth, very hard outer skin that gives it the stone-like appearance. The pigmented liquid, brownish in color, often revealed to adventurers when a mimic is wounded in battle, is held within the body in large muscular organs that serve as both bags and pumps. When these organs are squeezed by the contraction of the cavity wall muscle, they squirt their contents rapidly, within one round, into the outer skin layer, filling many capillaries that lie just beneath the skin's surface. These capillaries then stand out, brownish and wrinkled, in a pattern resembling wood grain. And then it goes on to provide some examples. It talks about what they can and can't eat, how they see, and talks about the difference between regular mimics and killer mimics. It says, mimics are interested only in personal safety and the endless quest for food. Killer mimics will attack any living creature, regardless of the number of adversaries or their powers. The more intelligent variety often prefers to bargain with an enemy initially, but the creatures have no moral standards as we know them. If an enemy is sufficiently weakened after a bargain's been struck, a mimic will change its mind, always seeking a meal first and foremost. And as we know, mimics can kind of glue people in place, and so it suggests that this is also how they travel. Basically, they stick out a pseudopod, they attach it to a surface with this glue, they pull themselves along, they dissolve the glue, repeat. And it suggests that the body of a mimic, or the skin of a mimic specifically, is useful in making potions. What potions, you may ask? Well, that'd be polymorph. It's just a fascinating combination of this kind of ecology article and magic, right? And that's very characteristic of Dungeons & Dragons in the 1980s. You can even see traces of it in the Monster Manual of the 70s, but there's maybe a more purely fantastical attitude. And this kind of, like, naturalism. I'm not the person who coined the term Gygaxian naturalism, and I'm not sure that it necessarily applies here, but there definitely was this kind of, like, oh, let's try and make the mimic make sense as a creature that could be evolved to live in a dungeon environment. Now, you might say that this actually just makes it more absurd, and I wouldn't necessarily disagree with you, but it's a very interesting article nonetheless. It's only one page long. Much of the issue of Dragon Magazine is full of yet more endless stuff about hells and some kind of preview monsters from Monster Manual 2. So we'll get to in a year or whatever when we're done with both the Monster Manual and the Fiend Folio. Anyway, back on track. So in this article, Greenwood refers to what is probably the most interesting thing about the mimic, i.e. that typical mimics are intelligent. It's only the killer mimic, the larger, more aggressive variant, that isn't as intelligent as a human. So mimics can talk, mimics can make deals, and if you provide a mimic with food, you can effectively domesticate it. Although, it's the kind of vicious creature that will turn on you if you show it weakness. So you have to be very cautious in your dealings with mimics. And actually, I think that's a good point, because mimics are quite powerful. Now, my last special, the one on the Bodic, was requested by Patreon backer Ted Prodromu. And like Reb, Ted is a friend of mine, and Ted and I were talking a while ago now, and he mentioned mimics. This was back around episode 40, the episode of the regular show in which I discussed the mimic. And Ted told me that he had run a game that had some mimics in it, and he went on to say, in my Lego Vikings game, which is a fantastic game that Ted's been running for many years and he's been telling me about, we totally use the fact that mimics are intelligent. There's actually a colony of mimics under a city that the PCs fought and later allied with. They had a great diplomacy moment where the PCs negotiated with a mimic while the mimic noted that there were dozens of other mimics in the room, all unseen if the PCs tried anything. Later on, one player had a solo adventure with a side NPC who'd been reincarnated as a harpy as a temporary character. That guy ended up teaming with a huge mimic with gliding abilities. Parentheses. There are feats and variants for mimics in Pathfinder because of Pathfinder's nigh-infinite system bloat. Close parentheses. He ended up in a sort of buddy crime story with the one mimic, which was like his sentient gliding hut ally, as they went out and nearly defeated an evil fairy prince. It turns out, mimic allies are really, really handy, because they can do a lot of tricks more useful and interesting than trapped treasure chest. But yes, mimics as intelligent monsters who can be, maybe sometimes, negotiated with is fun. And I mean, everything that Ted tells me about that game sounds like fun, but the key point is that a mimic can actually be a powerful ally, even if it's not willing to come along with you and share your dangers, which we have no reason to assume it would be. It sees everything that's going on in the dungeon, right? I mean, people just think it's a doorknob or a chair or whatever it might be, a bookcase. And so therefore, it has a good amount of information that it can share with you, assuming you keep it full of tasty chicken or whatever it is that it likes. The other problem, of course, is that a mimic is no more likely to favor you for treating it well than it is to favor anyone else. So you just got to assume that unless your opponents are the kind of chaotic evil sadists who would never, you know, make a mutually profitable deal with somebody, you're vulnerable to the same strategy being used by your enemies. The idea of a mimic as large as a building is a fun one. I just mentioned that Fawford and the Grey Mouser idea, and there's an old scenario by Marcus Rowland, the British game writer often known for his sort of humorous take on standard fantasy trope ideas, in which there are mimics who specifically are mimics of houses, you know, and they just kind of sit and they impersonate a house, and then someone walks in and they get gobbled up. So mimics are fun. What's really interesting about the mimic is that, well, mimics are a lot of fun, and it's very surprising that the specific image of the treasure chest is the one that's really taken off. And particularly because the original Monster Manual illustration doesn't have the treasure chest where the lid and frame have formed a giant toothy maw with a long tongue that is so standard an image of mimics. I'll talk about this toward the end. I think this is one of those instances where, because a particular implementation of a monster is so visually appealing, it's wound up being the one that is standard in other media. But that doesn't mean that it has to be what mimics are like in your Dungeons & Dragons game. Ooh, I should add that another idea that Greenwood mentions in the Ecology article limits the efficacy of the mimic ally outside of doors, which is that, you know, they don't have eyes. They have these sort of eye spot patches of pigment on their surface, which are overwhelmed by bright light. So they see very well in low light environments, like in dungeons, but they're effectively blinded by bright sunlight. So they're not going to, like, follow you around in the overworld helping you out, which is fun. It's actually not a bad way to limit their utility as pets. Anyway, a couple of episodes of Monster Man ago, I talked about vampires, and I posted about this. I try always to accompany my episodes with a photograph of a miniature, and that's, you know, partly because I have a big collection of miniatures and I like to take photographs of it, but also because I've learned through experience that my social media posts are always more popular when they have a picture. And this was the vampire episode, and it showed a vampire climbing out of its sarcophagus. And so there's the vampire model, and there's the coffin model behind it. And Twitter user Opposing Reflection posted speculating about the idea that the coffin could be a mimic. And I thought that was really funny. I thought, well, you know, what if that happened, right? What if you're a mimic and, you know, there you are in the dungeon and you've decided to take on the shape of the vampire's coffin? So the vampire climbs into the coffin and gotcha! You know, you gobble it on up. Now, of course, what would happen here was that the mimic, too, would presumably become a vampire, right? It drinks up all that vampire blood and it winds up becoming, you know, a vampire mimic. I wonder if this is how some vampires could be created, right? After all, so then you have, instead of, you know, a coffin that a vampire sleeps in, you would have a coffin that if you sleep in it, turns you into a vampire. Although, why you would sleep in a coffin if you weren't a vampire, I don't know. But on the other hand, the vampire mimic could presumably then turn into something else. Maybe it couldn't, you know. I mean, maybe becoming a vampire would preserve a mimic in its state, or maybe it would only be able to shift at night. I like the idea of a vampire mimic, but it's definitely high-concept D&D gonzo nonsense. You know, you have to know your players and really judge the tone right, because if I ran a game with a vampire mimic in it, some of my players would be really into it, and some of them would walk out. And for the ones that walk out, I wouldn't necessarily blame them. As with all weird dungeon ecology monsters, the most frequent explanation for the mimic is a wizard did it. That is to say that the creatures are the result of some kind of alchemical experimentation. Although, again, hard to see what the purpose of that experiment would be. You have to wonder if it was someone trying to turn themselves into a shapeshifter, but wound up sort of losing their normal state, right? So you put yourself, you know, like you tested this serum on you that would allow you to change into anything, and it did allow you to change into anything, but only within certain very narrow limits. On the other hand, we're sort of meant to believe that this is an evolutionary response to living in dungeons. The mimic is just an ambush predator. This is more thinking about the evolution of cognition than I really required for a Dungeons & Dragons monster podcast, but, you know, it seems like there are not a lot of stimuli to the mimic's intelligence, so I quite like the idea that they come from an intelligent species. This wouldn't explain the killer mimic unless you imagine that, you know, the state of creating the super one somehow drove them into a sort of, not a berserk rage, because they're not attacking all the time. They wouldn't be very useful if that were the case. They lost the ability to negotiate and communicate and just wound up being bigger and stronger, which is how they survive. I don't know. Again, the mimic raises the question of how much work and thought you want to put into a plausible ecology for your Dungeons & Dragons monsters. In some ways, I think they actually, let me put it this way, a plausible framework of some kind is very useful when dealing with Dungeons & Dragons monsters. Because for the really classic Dungeons & Dragons playstyle, monsters have to be a reason to think. Someone, and I don't remember who it was, but it might have been Bryce over at 10footpole.org, said that a lot of NPC backstories are essentially lengthy psychological explanations for why the NPC will never surrender, attacks on sight, and fights to the death. And if that was not Bryce, and it was someone else, and it was you, I apologize. But it's a fantastic truth, right? The idea that people were basically creating NPCs and monsters that were just unreasoning battle fiends, and then claiming that that was sophisticated gaming because there was an explanation for why that was the case, which seems a little bit to be missing the point. If there is a framework about the creature's behavior, tactics, prey, environment, whatever, that makes sense, then the players can observe that and use it to develop strategies, which is a very rewarding thing to have in games, right? The players feel clever because they're rewarded for being observant, and the moment feels unique because the players are using a combination of what they're observing in the game and the environment in the game rather than just their knowledge of the rules in the book to succeed. It's also very good as a DM because what it does is incentivizes the players to pay attention to what you're saying. Now, this is a double-edged sword, of course, because it means that if you say something that doesn't make sense, then the players will be more likely to notice it. So, you know, there are costs and benefits. But I don't think that it's necessarily the case that that system has to be a sort of pseudoscientific ecological one, right? It could be a folkloric one. If you're up against, you know, a fairy or a devil or something, it could very well have some kind of rule like, oh, it can't go into any room where there are cornflowers, or it can only harm someone who isn't pure of heart, or whatever, right? They could have something that doesn't have any kind of plausible quote-unquote scientific explanation, but as long as there is a consistent system of lore that surrounds it, and it is possible to infer elements of that system of lore from observing the creature's behavior and habitat, then that's an opportunity for a lot of fun. And that is true of all these dungeon habitat monsters, right? The idea that the mimic is basically an ambush predator that pretends to be a treasure chest and then gobbles people up makes some sense, and you can include elements of a dungeon that reflect that reality. So, for instance, you might find a bunch of chewed up bones next to what would appear to be like a shelf, but there's just an empty space on it. Well, that would give you some kind of hint that there are, you know, mimics in the vicinity. Of course, they've moved along because they wouldn't stay in one place unless they had an easy way to dispose of the bodies of their victims. And there's a mention of exactly that happening with a mimic posing as a statue in a town square in the Ed Greenwood article. You know, there's a nearby sewer that is throwing all the bones into, which is why people aren't just turning up to the square in the morning and seeing a big pile of remains around the statue and going, huh, that's weird. So the mimic is basically, if it provides a reason for the players to think, it doesn't really matter what the explanation of it is. But the Greenwood biological explanation seems like a fun one, and it works out okay. You can either say that it was created or that it evolved, you know, evolution being somewhat different here in the world of fantasy. And I don't think that really matters as long as there is a system that rewards interaction. Finally, the last interesting thing about the mimic, well, the last interesting thing about the mimic that I'm going to talk about in this episode anyway, is that mimics have appeared in a lot of other media. They're one of the things about Dungeons & Dragons that has gone directly into specifically computer gaming. A lot of electronic games in the RPG genre that have a mimic in them, often really just called a mimic. And that's fascinating because a lot of such games take elements directly from Dungeons & Dragons, but usually, because of the nature of D&D, those are things that have some other precedent in the literature of sword and sorcery or heroic fantasy or whatever. So yeah, these games have goblins because D&D has goblins, but D&D has goblins because folklore has goblins, so it's not as obvious. But when you look at something like, you know, Dark Souls or whatever, and it has mimics, I mean, I don't know. The fact is I don't really play a lot of electronic games, so I'm not actually sure what sort of games have mimics. I know Dark Souls has them for sure. And there, the treasure chest is just kind of the head of a creature which, like, pops up from being sort of folded underneath it. But there are lots of other computer RPGs that have mimics. And I suspect that this, you know, they have those. They don't have owlbears, and they don't have umber hulks, and they don't have other creatures that, you know, that appear in the D&D world. They don't have lurkers above and so on because those are very three-dimensional creatures and most of those games don't simulate that type of environment. But they have mimics because they because mimics are so intimately tied to the dungeon and treasure chest environment. And it's the dungeon environment that is the thing about D&D that's most interesting to creators of fantasy RPGs on the computer, right? Well, that and things like classes and levels and hit points. All the ways in which Dungeons & Dragons systematized a particular type of character advancement and turned player decision-making from a... not necessarily turned player decision-making into a flowchart, but created a type of tactical environment that essentially functioned as a sort of flowchart. So the dungeon goes into computer games because it's just such a good environment for creating the kind of focused choices that are important to those games. And then, once you have the dungeon and the dungeon is full of treasure chests, then you want to change it up in some ways, and that means introducing a mimic. So the mimic is a creature that springs, in many ways, directly out of the play culture of D&D, and also one that looks really good and is translatable into a variety of different formats in a way that, say, a lurker above is not, right? You couldn't have a lurker above in most early fantasy RPG computer games because there would be no way to represent a creature that was on the ceiling. This is probably not as fascinating to anyone else as it is to me, but it's just fun to see something that normally makes me think of a monster as being kind of artificial actually making a strength. And it doesn't hurt that the mimic has eventually... It doesn't hurt that the mimic eventually evolves this very distinctive character design that's really funny, and actually that winds up becoming the thing that is most recognizable about the mimic. Anyway, that's mimics. They're great, they have a lot of potential, and one of the nice things is that it's very possible in a Dungeons & Dragons game to deploy weird variants of the mimic. Like, I can put my vampire mimic into a game and not have to bother setting it up in too much detail, but because by this point, pretty much anybody who's likely to be sitting down and playing a game of Dungeons & Dragons with me knows what a mimic is. Indeed, thanks to the creature's prevalence in electronic games, there are people who've never played an hour of Dungeons & Dragons in their life who know what a mimic is and would get the idea of a vampire mimic that had turned into a coffin. It's a combination of two relatively well-known tropes, which is its strength. It's also kind of what makes it goofy, but, you know, that's what you get. So mimics, through a combination of the basic fun of the idea and their distinctive visual design, have become one of the building blocks that you can combine to create other things, which is not true of, say, the hook horror. So I hope that you've enjoyed this episode about mimics. As I said earlier, it is brought to you by the generosity of my Patreon backer, Reb. And if you'd like to be as cool and sophisticated as Reb is, you too can back the show by going to patreon.com/monsterman and pledging as little as $1 a month to support it. Friday, we'll bring a regularly scheduled episode of Monster Man, in which we're going to continue our journey through the W section of the Monster Manual. So please join me then for Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great. Thank you for listening.
Do you have a favorite monster? Do you have something you'd like me to talk about? Find me on Twitter at GonzoHistory or send me an email, gonzohistory@gmail.com. If you want to support the podcast, you can do so at patreon.com/monsterman, where you'll find lots of extra bonus content and my brand new show, Patron Deities, in which I explore the deities and demigods advanced Dungeons & Dragons book. Check it out. Thanks for listening.